I have another story to tell you today. This one is about a crime in which nature, not man, trapped a murderer. Do you want to hear it?
Now starring Paul Frees as your teller of tales, another story from The Black Book.
Yes, from the world's most fabulous collection of strange and unusual stories, The Black Book, I've selected a story by Nelson Bond. He calls it On Schedule. Mr. Henry Foster, manager of the Midwestern branch of Updike and Updike Investment Brokers, sat comfortably in the men's lounge of the club car as the train swayed and rumbled over the Jersey countryside. He had the quiet air of a conservative middle-aged businessman and held an expensive briefcase on his lap. He sat there gazing out of the window through the bright noon sunlight at New York's jagged skyline. It made him think of a huge stock market graph. And for the 100th time, Mr. Foster mentally reviewed the steps he must take. The wheels beneath him sang a deeper note as they hit the downgrade to the Hudson Tube. Mr. Foster studied his watch and thought to himself,
in 1 minute and 56 seconds, this car will enter the darkness of the tube. It will be absolute darkness, for I shall step from the lounge and throw the master switch. Every light in the club car will be cut off. Yes, my plan is perfect.
For the last three nights, Mr. Foster had taken this train from Jersey to New York, stopwatch in hand, plotting his every move. He knew that exactly 3 minutes and 39 seconds from the time the club car entered the Hudson Tube, it would glide into Pennsylvania Station carrying a dead passenger. Young Prentice, now so casually lounging in the last compartment smoking a cigarette with Detective Mooney, would be dead. His throat cut by the knife Mr. Foster had concealed in his briefcase. It was rather a shame, he thought, that Prentice must die, but there was no other way to handle it now. There'd really been no other way right from the start. From the very day he'd called the young accountant into his office for a very private conversation.
Come in.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Foster?
Oh, yes, Prentice. Have a chair. You recognize this, Prentice?
Of course, sir. It's one of our account books.
Right. Now, I've made notes here of certain entries in that particular volume that strike me as, let us say, in error.
What do you mean, sir?
What do I mean? Prentice, turn to page 67, if you will. Well, go ahead. Have it?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Harriman's account, is it not?
That's right, sir.
Now then, look at the entry of June 14th. Well, Prentice?
I don't understand, sir. Do you want me to read it?
No, Prentice, I've read it.
If there's an error, Mr. Foster, I'll check it immediately.
Too late, Prentice. $300 is missing. You're a fool to have taken it.
Mr. Foster sat back and waited for the young man to deny everything, or at least to think up some kind of an excuse for having doctored the firm's books. But Prentice did neither. In fact, it almost seemed to Mr. Foster that he was smiling, and this he was unprepared for.
If you'll agree not to press charges, Mr. Foster, I'll pay back the money as soon as possible.
Prentice, I had entertained rather high hopes for you. Seems a pity. And all for a mere $300.
May I go now, sir?
You'll resign, Prentice, but yes, you may pay back the money. And at least remember that if you must steal, Prentice, make it big, worthwhile.
I'll stay down tonight if I may and clean up the work on my desk.
If you like. Goodbye, Prentice.
Goodbye, sir.
It was a pity, Foster thought, to lose a young man he'd consider so promising. But at least the young fool might learn his lesson from it. Next morning, Mr. Foster found that he had, and learned it well. He was looking through his mail when the telephone rang. It was Prentice. He wanted to see Mr. Foster at once, and curiously, there was no pleading in his voice, but rather an amused tone of superiority and self-possession. A few moments later, he was seated in the office with an account book in his hand.
Do you recognize this, Mr. Foster?
What is it you wish to see me about, Prentice?
On page 20 in that book, you can see where I made $50 from Mrs. Jackson, the same way I made $300 from Mr. Harriman.
I haven't checked all the books yet, Prentice.
No?
If you have anything to say, Prentice, say it.
Oh, I have something to say, all right. I've been up all night studying these books, and I've discovered a few things I'd vaguely suspected. The most important being that the few $100 I've stolen are chicken feed compared to the thousands that have landed in your pocket.
Just what do you mean, Prentice?
I'll tell you. It took some time to figure out how you've been doing it, but I know now. I sort of stumbled on the answer, you might say.
I've heard just about enough, Prentice.
Not yet you haven't. Here's how it works. A client phones in to sell a certain stock. Now, this order must have your okay first. And when it reaches your desk...
Young Prentice talked on for an hour uninterrupted. For Henry Foster was something of a philosopher, and he found a certain wry humor in the fact that only through the cheap dishonesty of a mere accountant had his own really magnificent thievery been discovered. He allowed Prentice to finish and congratulated him on his cleverness. And then he made the only gesture possible under the circumstances. At first, Prentice was doubtful.
Yeah, but what if we're caught? We'd get 20 years at least.
Nonsense, nonsense. It's foolproof.
But $100,000 a year? That's too much.
Precisely. And that's why we'll never be caught. Remember, Prentice, only petty thieves are caught. $300 thieves.
Yes. You're right. I'll go along.
Good, good. Let's shake hands on it, my boy.
It was a strange partnership, the callow youth and the staid executive, both of them thieves. But even so, it went well for a few months until suddenly lightning struck. Mr. Foster was in his office when he heard about it.
Yes?
Listen, Foster. I'm at the corner in a phone booth. Ran out as soon as they came in.
What? Who came in?
The home office auditors. Three of them. They just walked into the office, unannounced as usual.
Right. Now you listen to me, Prentice.
Yeah.
Stop your sniveling and be a man. Now they can't discover a thing. Not a thing, unless you give it away with your foolishness.
But they'll suspect something. I'm sure of it.
Shut up and get back to your office. Do you hear me?
All right. But I'm scared.
As it turned out, young Prentice was right. The auditors did suspect something. And in the end, Foster was summoned to New York. His employers suspected, yes, but they could prove nothing. And Mr. Foster soon returned to the Midwest. His method of thievery was perfect. Or so he thought, until a New York detective, Ed Mooney, appeared on the scene. A few days after his arrival, Mooney came to Mr. Foster's office with terrifying news.
Well, Mr. Foster, that's the long and the short of it. Prentice is not as stable a character as you are.
Prentice is a fool, Mooney, and I'll have him in jail for such slander.
Maybe you will, maybe you won't. Meantime, we've offered him privilege of state's evidence freedom if he'll come to New York and give his information there.
Why, you mean you take the word of a mere boy before mine?
Oh, we'll check on everything he has to tell, all right.
All right, Mooney. Go ahead. Check all you like. You'll find nothing. Nothing.
We'll check. In good time.
And so it was that young Prentice must die. Detective Mooney was assigned to bring him east, and he was seated beside him now in the compartment at the end of the club car. For the last time, Mr. Foster looked at his watch. In 10 seconds, the car would enter the blackness of the Hudson Tube. He rose and stepped out into the narrow aisle. His hand found the light switch and jerked it down, plunging the car into complete darkness. Then he moved through the startled passengers to Prentice's compartment. This, too, he'd rehearsed the night before. 17 strides to the end of the aisle. 1 minute and 3 quarters in all to reach the compartment. And a split second to plunge the silencing knife into Prentice. That left 2 full minutes to race up to the car in front. Then the train would be at Pennsylvania Station. Before anything could be done, Foster would be lost in the streets of New York. 15 steps. 16. 17. He turned now and opened the compartment door. His outstretched hand found the tweed-clad figure of Prentice.
What?
The knife blade stabbed and twisted. And then suddenly... sunlight! Fierce and brilliant sunlight flooding the car, revealing everything. Prentice's horrified and gasping face. Foster, knife in hand, and Detective Mooney with a gun already half out of his pocket. Utterly bewildered, Foster jumped back and the sunlight vanished as quickly as it came. He turned down the corridor just as Mooney fired. The bullet smashed between his shoulders, driving him forward onto the carpet. Mr. Foster came to for a moment just as the train was grinding to a stop at the station platform. 2 thick-soled brogans that were Mooney stood like walls close to his eyes as he lay there on the floor of the club car.
The fool. A pitiful, murdering fool. If he lives, he'll get the chair for this. You know, it's funny how it timed out. So's he stabbed Prentice just as we hit the light of the air shaft.
Mr. Foster's eyes closed in shame as much as in physical pain. The air shaft. Yes, that's all it was. An air shaft full of bright noon sunlight. His one mistake, the one flaw in his otherwise perfect plan. You see, he'd timed everything on night trains only.
The Black Book stars Paul Frees as your teller of tales, assisted today by the noted Hollywood actor John Daner. Nelson Bond's story, On Schedule, was adapted by John Meston and directed by Norman McDonald. The special music is composed and conducted by Leith Stevens.
Next week, I'll have another story for you from The Black Book. It's most unusual, and it's called My Favorite Corpse.
Tonight, Playhouse on Broadway brings you the big finals of its intercollegiate acting competition. 4 talented campus performers compete in a specially written play in which one of them will win $2,000. Don't miss this dramatic program tonight on most of these same CBS radio stations. Clarence Cassell speaking. Remember, the comedy treat that can't be beat is Jack Benny Time, Sunday nights on the CBS Radio Network.
Well, we have a little bit of time left, and earlier I had mentioned a series called Studio X, in which Paul Frees performs all of the voices. And so let's hear just an excerpt of one of the episodes from that series. This is episode 3 from 1948, entitled The Professor Goes for a Walk. And keep in mind, every single voice you hear on this particular show is that of Paul Frees.
All right, Denny. We've got you and your mob completely surrounded. Now, are you coming out peacefully, or do we have to blast you out?
For an answer, Captain Murphy of the 63rd Precinct received a withering flame of machine gun fire from a second-story window. His police squad ducked behind bulletproof cars and armored cycles. With swift movements of shuffling feet, Professor Cosmo Jones sidled up to Murphy.
Pardon me, Captain, but may I suggest that I be allowed to intercede?
The big policeman turned around and his face twisted in a mixed picture of surprise and rage.
So, it's you again, Cosmo Jones, you little mouse. Now listen, will you go home and crawl under the bed before you get hurt? These guys are killers.
He turned toward the police car's microphone.
All right, mate. Let him have it.
And that's the dramatic opening to another story from Studio X, starring America's most versatile actor, Mr. Paul Frees, who will return after a few profitable moments with your announcer. And here is your star of Studio X, Mr. Paul Frees.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to Studio X and our presentation of The Professor Goes for a Walk. During a slight lull in the firing, Professor Cosmo Jones took advantage of another opportunity to approach the police captain and tugged at his sleeve.
If you please, Captain Murphy, I have a very good suggestion as to how...
Listen, didn't I tell you to get back out of here?
Murphy turned back to his men. Cosmo reached up and tapped him on the shoulder.
I'm quite sure that if you'll just listen...
The captain went livid with rage and choked up. And from then on, the police did everything to get Cosmo out of the way. They pushed him around. They jostled him aside. Meanwhile, the battle carried on with Murphy directing hostilities toward the hoodlum hideout and shaking himself free from the professor who constantly tugged at his coat. Finally, it was the little fellow himself who gave up in disgust. Grasping his walking stick and umbrella firmly in one hand, he calmly walked out right in the center of no man's land. Standing there in the white beams of police searchlights, he was a perfect target for gunfire from either side. Captain Murphy nearly had a heart attack as he screamed into the microphone.
Hold your fire! Hold your fire!
Beads of sweat oozed out of his forehead as he addressed the professor.
Get out of here, you little dope! Come over here before you get a bullet in the pants! Come on, hurry up!
But Cosmo had made up his mind to take a different course of action. He approached the opposite curb, threw back his head, and called up to the second-story window.
Gentlemen, I should like to have a talk with you. I'm sure you won't mind if I come upstairs.
There was no firing, no response from the window. Without a moment's hesitation, the professor entered the building and proceeded up the stairs. At the top of the landing, he knocked on the wooden panel and waited until the door was jerked open. He boldly stepped across the threshold under the guidance of two men bristling with guns. There were two other men inside, and the room looked like a small arsenal. The shades were ripped away from the glass-shattered windows, tables and chairs were overturned, and the place was in a thorough state of shambles. The only light in the room came from the searching ribbons of police lights and the bright glow of street lamps on the outside. The professor stood there meekly until the man who seemed to be Donnelly, the leader, spoke.
What you got on your mind, screwball?
Cosmo stood perfectly quiet as he answered.
Well, gentlemen, to be perfectly frank with you, I was thinking that you might save yourselves a lot of trouble by raising a flag of truce, laying down your arms, and submitting peacefully to the officers of the law.
A tough-looking individual with a scar that ran from his temple to the corner of his mouth barked at Donnelly.
What is this guy? Nuts?
The professor was quick to give assurance.
Oh, no, gentlemen. I can set your minds at ease by saying that I'm not a victim of dementia praecox. Definitely not.
Scarface barked again.
Hey, listen to the guy. He's swearing at us.
Vanelli spat out a command.
Shut up, Augie.
Then he waved a gun at the professor.
What are you? A copper?
Oh, no, heavens no. I'm not a minion of the law. I'm a doctor of science.
The leader bobbed his head at the gang.
Meet the doc, you monkeys. A guy who don't know when he's well off by keeping his bugle out other guy's business. Well, you get this, Flappy Ears. We don't go for your ideas. Because I ain't got no time to waste, I'm gonna polish you off.